Hello, and welcome to Dave's Book Talk. Today we're going to talk to an author. His name is Linwood Barclay. He's a New York Times bestselling, international bestselling author. And his new book is called The Accident, and I am absolutely love this book. And he's here to join us. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Excellent.
Are you Canadian, born in Canada, or were you born somewhere else?
I was born in Connecticut. I was born in the U.S., and
wow.
My parents moved to Canada just as I was about to turn 4 years old. They moved to the suburbs outside of Toronto, and I've lived in Canada ever since. So I'm actually a dual citizen. I was born in the U.S., but I've lived all but, you know, 3.5 years of my life in Canada.
You enjoy Fielding and Chevy Stevens, and there's somebody else. There seems to be a lot of Canadian authors.
Yeah, Louise Penny. And
Louise
Robinson.
Penny. That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
But this book, The Accident. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, and Giles Blunt, another Canadian author.
Oh, yeah. His books are wonderful.
He's a great writer.
I haven't talked to him in years.
Yeah, he's really, really good.
This, in my opinion, is your best book. There's something about this book that when people finish it, they're going to know exactly what I mean, because it's just so well written. It's so different than what you expect, and there's a lot of twists and turns in it. That's exactly the kind of book I like. Do you strive to do that? Is that something you consciously try to do?
You're talking about the twists?
Yeah.
Or I think so. I mean, I'd like to have them. I'm not really able to plan them out ahead of time. I just sort of find ways as I'm going along to be able to provide them. And sometimes it's a question of surprising myself. I mean, I'll going along and I'll think, well, I know what I'm going to do next. And then what if I didn't do what's the most logical thing to do next? And I do something different. And sometimes those little things work and sometimes they don't, but you know, when you find that they do, they're fun to do. I mean, I usually know the big picture when I'm writing a book. I mean, I know my end point, I know who's done it, I know that, all these things. And so I do kind of have a bit of a plan when I get started, but once I get going, I find all these little opportunities present themselves that I didn't know were going to be there.
Well, there's nothing worse than reading a book and have it be, and have get to the end and find out it's exactly what you thought it was going to be.
I mean, yeah, it's funny. I just read a book like that. It was actually really, really well written, but I was like, I was 150 pages from the end, and I thought, oh, I know what it's going to be, and I was right.
Yeah, that's not a good feeling.
But there was no surprise element.
Yeah, there's got to be. That's what I like, anyway.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, one tries, you know, to have as many twists as you can. And in fact, the book that I've done for next year, I think it's got one even in the last third of a page, then we had one that was quite that close to the end.
We can't really talk about the twists and turns of the book, unfortunately, but there is one particular one in this book that just blew me away with its cleverness, and I'm anxious for my readers, whoever's listening right now, to read that. And when you get to that part, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. But I can't even tell you who it was or what the twist is, because I'll give away the whole friggin' book before the book's even out. I don't want to do that, because this book's so wonderful, and to describe it any more than to say that the accident is very important to the story. That's where it all starts, this accident on the road.
It's funny, and we were struggling for the longest time for a title for that book. I was going to call it Only Death Is Real, because there's a lot of some of the backstory in this book is about knockoff counterfeit merchandise and
right.
What's real, what isn't. And we came up with like just dozens of titles, and none of them seemed to work. And then finally my editor said, what if we did a the title, the something? And then they said, oh, The Accident. And, you know, like, why couldn't we have thought of that in the first place?
It is. It works perfectly. And it is one of the central parts of the book. And it's just a perfect title, I think. And the beginning of it, the two ladies shopping for the knockoff pocketbooks in the back of the store, it's a great scene to set up the story. But the thing is, you're like, what does this have to do with the story? And you don't know till later on what exactly the connection is, which is another cool thing. It's another little twist, and you're thinking, well, you know, how is he just? Did he just throw this in accidentally? Accidentally,
yeah.
Listen to me now. But
it does. Yeah, there was a lot of talk of the times about that prologue, whether to keep it or not. And we thought, well, we need a crime early in the book, and there is a crime in that prologue, and so at least we kick the book off with a crime. And then, because otherwise the story has a kind of way of evolving and then unfolding things in a kind of natural way. natural order. And so we threw that at the beginning and thought, not only is this really what, in many ways, the story is about, but it gives us a way to kick it off.
Definitely. With a bang is it. Glenn Garber, I was right the first time. Shoot, I knew I was going to say the name wrong. Glenn Garber, who is the central character. There are times in this book where I don't like him at all.
Yeah, that's okay.
And that's unusual to feel that way about a main character. I found myself getting really angry with him and really frustrated with him, and I could feel his frustration. And he has points in this book where he just goes off.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not... Well, I mean, I
mean, are you like that in real life?
Well, I probably... Yeah, sure. I mean... none of us is perfect, you know, and there are aspects to our personalities that all of us have that, you know, that not everybody's crazy about.
But
the character's less believable if he's just adorable in every respect, you know.
My feeling is that he goes farther than he should a couple times in this book, and then I was telling myself, thinking later, well, maybe he didn't. So this book makes you think a lot. It makes you think, what if you were in his position and your wife was dead and had an accident and was dead and you weren't quite sure what was going on, whose fault it really was, what would you be like? Wouldn't you want to find it? You'd do anything to find that answer.
And this guy, Glenn Garber, is this contractor whose wife, he loses his wife in this accident. I mean, he's got so many pressures. I mean, aside from this personal tragedy, I mean, he's in a slump. You know, he's trying to get through a real big downturn in the economy, and we all know about that. And he's got somebody who wants to sue him. He's got one of his houses burned down that he builds. This guy's got more problems than you can imagine.
And that's the thing. He handles his problems really well, too. I mean, if I were in his position, I'd probably be a basket case.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think he gets close to that a couple times. You know, he's kind of, it's just like, what else can happen to me?
But thank God he's got a daughter. His daughter is really what saves him in this book.
I think it's what holds him together. I mean, that's his reason for sticking it out and for, you know, holding it together and finding out what happened is because now he's raising his daughter on his own and he's, you know, he's not going to fail her.
I love it. There's a particularly really good scene between him and his mother-in-law, which is absolutely memorable in this book. And, you know, it makes you wonder, you know. I think to myself, if I were married, would I ever have a bad mother-in-law like that? Would I ever have a... But you never know what you're going to get, you know. When you marry your wife, you know, you don't know what her relatives are like, or do you? I mean, nobody bases it on whether you marry somebody on their relatives or not, but... But she's certainly a spitfire. I don't know what else to call her.
Yeah, she's not a whole barrel of laughs, that's for sure. His mother-in-law, who thinks that it'd be much better if she were to step in and take care of this kid and send her off to school and never live with her. I mean, and that's just not something Glenn's going to go along with. You know, at one point there was someone discussed whether Glenn would have a love interest in this book.
Mm.
And I said, the only thing that matters to him now is his daughter. He hasn't got time for that. He doesn't care about having a love interest. And to me, the whole idea of having a main character like that sort of have a romantic entanglement that soon after his wife had passed and he's looking after his daughter, I thought, that just doesn't work for me. You know, like that's not going to happen because I tried to imagine myself in this guy's situation. And that's not even in my radar to be looking for that.
That's interesting. You mentioned that they wanted to put a love interest in it. So
it wasn't so much that someone was pushing for it. It's just that it was sort of raised. They had thought that was maybe going to happen in the book. And I thought, no, that's not. That's he didn't care anything about that right now.
What do you do?
Right.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I keep stepping on your words. I have so many questions, and I'm so eager to talk to you.
Fire away.
You're really so good at writing. I mean, you're obviously. I mean, and I've read three of your books and enjoyed all three of them. Now, that's not to say I've read. I don't know. I haven't read the other ones yet. I'll get to them eventually. But I just enjoy the way you tell a story. I enjoy your characters. Your characters are real in this book. That's what makes this book something special. The characters are real. I mean, you really feel like you know these people.
I'm glad you say that, and I appreciate that because I think that might be more true even in this book than in any of the others because I think their problems are so real. You know, I've always liked writing about really kind of ordinary people who have very, you know, kind of ordinary jobs. I mean, in this book, my hero was a contractor. In my last book, he was a reporter, but in the one before that, I had a hero who was a car salesman. And I mean, the people that I know, that's what they do. Like, they're teachers and they're car salesmen and they're this and they're that. And so I like writing about people like that, kind of ordinary people caught in extraordinary circumstances.
I mean, everybody has ideas. I mean, I have ideas about a book I'd like to write, but the execution of it, actually knowing where to go with it, how, what to put in each chapter, and all the little intricacies, is that difficult for you, or does that come easy to you?
Well, it's what I love to do. If I were to be doing what you're doing right now and call up somebody who plays the piano, and, you know, if a jazz artist, I would think, I have no idea how you do that. I mean, does that part come easy? Does that part come, you know, how do you do that part? And I'm sure a lot of them would say, I don't know, I just do it. And sometimes that's kind of what happens when I'm doing a book. I mean, sometimes the things that people key in on and say, I love the way you do this or did that, those are the parts that I didn't even think about. I didn't even give any thought to them. I just kind of wrote them. And the things that I sort of agonized over are the things that perhaps are less obvious. I mean, certainly just the plotting a novel itself is I think for me, is the thing that I find the most work. I'm not saying I necessarily would find it, that it's hard, but it's the most work to get a plot that really works and that everything fits together and you're not sort of jamming a square peg into a round hole to make it work, because it's like the plot's kind of clunking along. And I can make it work if I have this sort of outlandish coincidence or something like that, and then it will all work. And I hate those kinds of things. So it's to find a plot and make it all mesh and, you know, get the gears all working together is, I think, that for me is the trickiest part, the part that needs the most attention. Sometimes the other things, that's just writing, and then that turns out to be the stuff that people really like.
But it never becomes overwhelming to you, like it's too much. It's like how do you come up with all these ideas, and how do you make them seem? Everything's got to be perfect. Not necessarily perfect. I don't know if that's the right word, but everything's got to make sense. The book has to make sense, or
it has to make sense. Yeah, I totally agree with you.
When I read a book, I mean, I've read many authors that, well, I read one of their books, and it's like, all right, it was all right. I wouldn't rave about it, but I can read it. I really don't believe the characters are real people. And, you know, and nowadays where they're trying to make a lot of money off authors, and that's fine, but I want a book that has depth. I want a book where I feel like I know the characters. I want a book that's a good story, that's interesting, that gets me saying to myself, I need to know how this book is going to end. And that's the way the accident is.
And that's also, and how the book ends is another thing that's important to me, in the sense that, this is a thriller, and it has twists, and it has, you know, I think it has some surprises, and there's an element to, like, you know, figuring out who did it and so forth. But to me, it's not enough for a book's resolution to be just a surprise, like you go, oh, that's who did it. Okay, that's a surprise. But it has to be more than that. It has to be a surprise, but it also, finding out who did it in a mystery has to mean something. It's not just that, oh, we tricked you and it was the butler all the time or whatever. I mean, but it has to be, that resolution has to have some kind of resonance for me. It has to have some meaning, so that it's not just that we found out who did it, but what does it mean that it was that person who did it? I mean, what does it mean to you emotionally? And it has to have some kind of impact. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying I'm always able to do it, but that's what I try to do. Mm-hmm. And so if that adds any sort of the depth to it, then I'm getting where I'd like to try to be. You know.
Right. There's so many elements to this book, and they're all going through my head right now, half of which I can't even bring up because I'll give something away.
I know, it's a tricky, you know, even for me, it's a tricky book to talk about because, I mean, I think there are sort of twists or revelations.
What would you say to get people to read it? What I would tell them, and I do sell books at a bookstore, and this is going to be my pick when it comes out in a couple weeks. I think it's coming out next week or the week after.
August 9th, yeah.
August 9th, which is, seems like it's, but what I would tell somebody is it's not only a good story, it's a good mystery, and it's a good thriller, and it's one of these books you can just take and enjoy. And it's a where is this going kind of book that just really gets you interested.
I think it's all of those things, and I think it's also a book about what our lives are like now. I mean, we're not all dealing, of course, with a murder and you know crimes and so forth, but I think the whole book is set against this backdrop of a troubled economy and how people are going to desperate measures to make ends meet.
And how fitting, and that's exactly what's going on in the world right now. I mean, everybody's trying to make a buck. I mean, how can I make extra money?
I know, and some people are doing it by, for example, you know, in a seemingly sort of harmless way, which is these purse parties where you know that are happening in these lovely, respectable suburbs, and someone's bringing in all these knockoff bags and purses that purport to be Louis Vuitton and Kate Spade and Fendi bags, but in fact they're just cheap knockoffs.
So you're making a statement here by writing this, by saying, you know, this stuff is wrong and this is your way of...
Well, to some degree, yeah, I think it is wrong. I mean, I think that kind of knockoff bogus merchandise. I mean, it is.
But who wouldn't be tempted by to do something like that?
And I think they're tempted, and I think they are tempted. And I think that one of the reasons they are is because to them it seems like a kind of a victimless crime, because you know that these, like, you know, Gucci is not going to suffer and go to bed hungry tonight because I bought this bag with a Gucci label on it that's not really a Gucci bag. But what's not thought about is the fact, well, who made this bag? Where did it come from? And how did it get to America? And what kind of bad people, you know, brought this over? And what, and the money that you buy, that you spend on this bag, where does that money go and who does it go to? And do they use that money to go and, you know, run a drug ring and make crystal meth and all that sort of stuff? I mean, it's very easy to forget, or to, you know, it's easy to not want to know what this is really all about. It's just a fun party. We're getting knockoff bags for cheap for next to nothing.
Right.
And isn't this a lark? And we can sit in our little nice suburban homes and not have to give a single thought to who may or may not be getting hurt by this activity.
See, I would end up feeling guilty that I'd given somebody something that wasn't really what it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of people knowingly buy these. There's a sort of reverse cachet about having a bag that's a knockoff. It's like, look at this bag. This bag, it looks just like a Fendi bag, but it's not. And I got it for $50. And everybody goes, oh my God, that's hilarious. That's great. And they think it's neat. But what you have in your hand is a piece of illegal merchandise. And a lot of people may have along the way been harmed for this to have happened. And so that's just one sort of little thing about the accident is that underground economy and this illicit kind of business going on.
But how early in the thought process of writing this book do you think about that bag aspect? I mean, do you put that in there? Was that something that you decided, well, I'm going to write a story around that, or did it come as a result of the story and you just thought, well, that would be perfect to put that in there?
I have been, well, my, and of course I'm surrounded by people who are much more interested in handbags than I am,
right.
Including my literary agent and my wife and my daughter and so forth. But my agent had brought to my attention one time this massive story that had run in, I think it was in the Toronto Star where I used to work, about this whole industry of the knockoff bags and how it would make an interesting backdrop for a crime story. So I kind of hung on to that and thought about it for a while, and then I started thinking about I think the first little glimmers about this book had to do with kids going to other people's houses for a sleepover, because that's also, we haven't even talked about that, but that's also an element in this book in which you send your little daughter to a friend's house for a sleepover, and she hears or sees something at someone else's house that she should not. And that was really the starting point way back when I started doing this book. And then it was, well, what? Then you start thinking, as a writer, you start thinking, okay, that's a really cool idea about the sleepover, because that hits us all where we live if we have kids. We've all had kids over for a sleepover, or we've sent our kids out somewhere for a sleepover. And when kids are little, and that's when they, you know, they're going for the first time, there's a lot of anxiety around it on the part of the parents and on the part of the child. And I started thinking about that, thinking about the neat way into a story. And so then I thought, well, what did she hear, or what did she see, or what did she think she saw? And I started thinking about that. And at some point, there was this idea about the accident itself, about someone who's had a terrific car, terms of, you know, a horrific car accident in which drunk driving is involved, and how the person to blame, it seems totally, who's to blame is, it's totally out of their character to have, you know, gotten into a car drunk and driven and done that. And so you start getting this sort of disparate ideas, and you start thinking, these can all be woven together, and we can have some fun with this. And
why is deals come that easy? You make it sound easy, like it all coalesced into your mind into one big, oh wow, I can do all this together. But it's got to, I mean, how long does it take to come up with all those ideas?
Well, it's funny. Some ideas, some of the books I've done, the idea, it's very sort of, there's a kind of moment when it all crystallized, and I think, this is what I'm going to do. Like, that was the case when I wrote a book called No Time for Goodbye.
Right.
And you think, I've got this idea, and it just all comes together. This book really was, I think, took a little longer to sort of percolate in my head, because there was this sleepover idea, there was this whole bit about purses, and it over a period of perhaps a month or so, everything kind of began to coalesce, and I thought, all these things can be worked together into one story. And I started, you know, when I'm sort of getting to the point where I want to start a book, or if not necessarily must start a book, because I'm on contract to do one a year.
Right.
I start sitting down with a notebook, and I start writing down ideas and thoughts and this and that. And I usually do that for about a week or 10 days. And then I think I know what my story is.
So I guess what you can do is, after you see all these ideas listed, you just take the ones that you think would correspond with another idea and put it all together in a book.
Yeah, usually I know what the overall idea of the book is, and then I think, okay, who are the people that this is happening to? And I start making out little character sketches of who the people are and so forth. But then I reach a point where I think, you know what, I'm just going to start writing, because that's when, for me, it starts kind of gelling. It really starts coming together, because then you realize with each paragraph, as you write it, you think, oh, well, I really need to get into this, and I need to get into this. And those are things that are impossible for me to sort of figure out ahead of time.
Right.
But I have that rough idea. And so, but that book, I mean, and the thing is, you know, it may look like, oh, it was all brilliantly planned and so forth, but, I mean, there was a totally different opening for that book when I first wrote it than what you see now. There was sort of, the book opened with an italicized chapter of a conversation or of what was overheard at a sleepover.
And that was
my opening.
Right.
And then we started thinking, well, let's maybe do that part more chronological, and we'll get to that when it actually happens in the book. But we're going to start with this wonderful little almost short story in itself of two women from Ohio who go to New York and go down to Canal Street because they're so excited to get a couple of knockoff purses to take back home with them, and things don't work out very well for them.
Right, and I think it works. It's very effective, and I can't even tell that you might have had them in a different order at one point, and that's how seamless it is. It really just reads really well. And you know, I'm not a big fan of prologues sometimes, because it just confuses me sometimes. I think, well, I need to know why that's there. What the heck is going on with that? Because it gets me angry sometimes, because it's this need to know thing inside of my head. But I've let it play out.
Sometimes I like a prologue. I mean, I understand what you're saying. I mean, Elmer Leonard, who's one of my favorite writers, I mean, he has his sort of famous 10 rules for writing, and some of which I agree with, and some of which I think are great to break, and one of which I love, which is never start with weather, which I totally agree with. But he says never do prologues. And I think, well, there's no hard and fast rules. I mean, I like prologues sometimes because if you want to tell a story in a kind of linear way, a lot of times it takes a while for the tension to build and for things to sort of unfold. And if you tell it in a linear way, the reader may lose interest before you get to the stuff that's, you know, where all hell breaks loose.
Right, excellent. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think it's nice, a prologue can kind of give you a little hint, here's the hell breaking loose, and this is what you're going to get to, and we're going to give you a taste of it now to whet your appetite. And then the prologue is going to end, and then we're going to start our story in a kind of linear fashion.
Right.
And that's why I find that they're kind of helpful. And I don't always do them, but every once in a while I do a prologue.
Well, I think it works very well here. And people who will read this book will understand completely at the end where it's all coming from. So give it a chance, I say, if you haven't already. Now, the accident, Danham's idea of having a green cover, you know, it is strangely very effective.
Yeah, it's interesting.
The green headlights and the green letters. It's sort of, I like it.
I like it too, and it's funny. My cover in England for this book is the exact same sort of concept, but a totally different execution. And I love both of them. They're just totally different. The American cover has a sort of close up of a vehicle, sort of like it's coming right off the cover at you, going through some rain. Whereas the UK one has these very distant headlights way down the road. It's a kind of more ominous look. But they're both really nicely done.
And you have your big picture on the back. And how do you get a big picture like that on the back? That's not very, you don't see that very often, where the author's picture like that.
It was just such a darn good one.
No, you're very photogenic. It looks, and you look really kind of creepy there too.
Yeah, that's really funny. And it's funny when my kids saw that picture. That picture takes like at least 5 pounds off my face. I love it. And when my kids saw that, they said, "Oh yeah, we know that look. That's when Dad would lecture us." Of course, my kids are now well into their 20s, but they looked at that picture and they just laughed. But it's a nice shot.
I mean, it's so easy when you become, and I don't know how many countries you're published in, but it's probably 20, 25?
About 40.
40? Oh
my God. And about 40 countries now, last I heard.
That's extremely impressive.
We're just about, I don't think we're in Iceland. We're kind of worried about Iceland, but we're just about everywhere else. And my books are doing, like, No Time for Goodbye in French translation has been number one on the French Amazon for months.
And let me say this without, I don't want to offend you or anything, but when I first was handed a copy of No Time for Goodbye, you know, I thought to myself, oh, here's another thriller writer. I mean, there's so many out there. And your immediate reaction is, well, how good can this one be?
Now, yeah, we're everywhere.
I have to confess, I did not read No Time for Goodbye, but I did read three of them, which I enjoyed immensely. And I'm sorry I didn't read No Time for Goodbye. I'm probably
going to... No Time for Goodbye was the book that changed my life, was that one, because I had, before No Time for Goodbye, I wrote four what I would call comic thrillers. Bad Move, Bad Guys, Lone Wolf and Stone Rain, and they were all about a character named Zach Walker, who was, you know, and they're quite funny books, although they do get darker as they progress. And the feeling was, you know, it's time to change direction. The books got nice reviews, but they didn't sell very many copies, and so it's time to go kind of darker and do something different. And so,
yeah, series is weird. The people either love it or don't.
Yeah, and so I wrote this book called No Time for Goodbye, and that was the one that changed everything for me, because in other markets, like in, it just went crazy. Like No Time for Goodbye was the single best-selling novel in England in 2008.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was, and it's been optioned for film by Eric McCormack, who was, you know, Will and Will and Grace, and he's trying to get it made into a movie. It's been a huge bestseller in Germany. It's been a huge bestseller in France. That book has been sold all over the world.
Why do you think it sold so well? I mean, what is your take on that?
Well, there's a couple things. I mean, first of all, in England, it was in fact, there was an Oprah-like show in England that picked it among several others for sort of recommended summer reads. But even at that, it became the biggest selling book in the history of that show's book club. So it was something more than just the fact that it got the publicity. And there was no TV show in Germany that recommended it, and in Germany it was a massive hit in 2007. I think it's because that book touches a nerve. And the premise of that novel is about a 14-year-old girl who wakes up one morning and her house is empty. Sometime in the night, her father, her mother, and her brother just disappeared, and she wakes up completely alone. And 25 years go by, and she never knows what happened to her family. You know, it's like, were they somehow, you know, all killed by somebody and who came into the house and somehow they missed her? Or are they all still alive and decided to leave her behind? And which would be worse? Would it be worse to find out that everyone in your family was dead, or to find out that they were all alive and didn't want you with them? And I think that premise, you know, and of course the other thing is 25 years after this all transpired, things start to happen that are going to, you know, provide her the answers to the question that she's always had, and she might be better off never knowing.
And see, that's a big pull in a book. You know, how can you start a book like that and not finish it?
Well, and that's what happened. And I think that book just hit everybody where they live, because I think we've all had this fear of being abandoned, of losing our parents. What would happen if we were all left behind? There was something in that that just touched people, and they read that opening chapter where this girl wakes up one morning after, and then the night before she'd had a huge fight with her parents because she was drinking at the age of 14. She'd been out with a boy they didn't like, and she went collapsed into bed and just passed out. And wakes up the next day, and they're all gone. And I think people read that and thought, I could have been, that girl could be me, and what would I do if this had happened to me? And I can't imagine what would it be like to wake up and not have my family.
One of our basis fears, I think, is abandonment. What would happen if everybody abandoned us?
And I think that's what happened in that book. I think that's what, it just touched the nerve. And it's, a, and I mean, if I can say it, it's a nice, you know, good cracking, good thriller. But I think that's what did it. And that book really, really, truly changed my life. That book allowed me to quit my, I'd been working for the Toronto Star for 27 years.
Wow.
And I left that job. And I loved my job there. I absolutely, I was a columnist there. I loved it.
So how old were you when you started at the Star?
How old?
Yeah.
I was 26 when I got to the Toronto Star.
26, wow.
And I worked in, I was an editor in all sorts of positions, and I was a columnist for the last 15 years. I was there doing a humor column, three columns a week, and I was finding that doing, you know, I started having a book a year come out in 2004, and I was finding writing a novel a year and still doing like 130 columns a year was starting to be almost too much for me. And
I can't, I'm looking at your picture and thinking, he looks like he's in his 40s. You do, you have a very youthful face.
Retouching is an amazing thing, you know. But
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, but I was going to say, and this is going to sound really weird, but can you promise me the next book's going to be as good as The Accident?
Oh, it's better.
You think it's better?
It's better. It's all done.
Can I read it now?
I just got the copy edited manuscript in the mail today. It's done. And all of those who have seen it, and that really just includes my editors and my agent, but everybody thinks that the next one is definitely the best book I've done. And it far outstrips even The Accident. And,
well, now I can't wait to read
it. My concern is, what am I going to write after that? And starting in October, I'll start working on the book that would come out in 2013. And I have no idea what the hell it's going to be.
Does that scare you at all?
A little bit. But it's kind of exciting too, in its own way.
How do you feel before a book comes out? I mean, are you worried about what the response is going to be with every book, or have you pretty much? You're pretty established now.
But you still do worry. I mean, I think you worry. Will anybody know it's out there? I think in some ways the biggest worry. Will anybody know that it's out there and it's in stores and that it's available, and will they find it? And I think the biggest thing in writing books and in publishing is word of mouth, and you know, you can put all the ads out there you want and do all those sorts of things, but what I think sells a book more than anything else is someone reading it and telling somebody else, man, you got to read this book. Because I've seen books on the stands that were bestsellers, and I just ignore them for months, and then someone I know and I trust will say, did you read such and such? It's so good. And then I think, oh, okay.
I'm starting to think there's something in the Canadian water. Because, I mean, I love your books. I love Chevy Stevens, and I love Louise Penny. And Giles Blunt. We talked about Giles Blunt, too. And you're all terrific writers.
Well, you know, I don't know, maybe it's the water. I don't know. It's so cold out that for so much more of the year that we have nothing else to do but stay indoors and write.
I just wish Chevy Stevens would let me interview, or she refuses to let me interview. I have no idea why. I feel like I'm...
Well, I don't know why. Well, I'll tell her you're lovely. You know?
Yeah, please do. It might help. I mean, because she's
I wonder why that is. No, I met Chevy at the Vancouver International Writers Festival. I ran into her there. I met her for the first time. And I don't know why that would be.
I think it's all a matter of timing. She, for some reason, they just get her doing so many different things when the book's out. Eventually I will. And something happened to one of her pets too. So I think she's a
very
little,
nice, very nice person. And we've got a few people doing crime up here, and in fact, we got quite a few doing it, but. A few of us are getting known beyond Canada.
I mean, you should be flattered. I there's so many questions I want to ask you, and I keep stepping on your words, but I mean, that's how excited I get about books, and I'm very, very, very excited about this book, and I'm not just saying that because I'm interviewing you. We wouldn't be talking right now if I didn't really like this book. There's no sense to me saying great things about a book if it's not great.
Well, I really appreciate that. I'm glad. Because, you know, when you go through this whole process of writing a book, I mean, you go a long time in the process before you start getting feedback. You know, you generally hand in a novel about a year before it comes out. And it's the tremendous lead time. And so you've had a long time to think about that book before you start getting any kind of feedback and any kind of feeling about whether people like it or not.
It's interesting because you talk about this book like it's been a while since you wrote it, and it probably has been a little bit of
it has.
I mean, it's fresh to me because I just read it last weekend. But it's interesting to hear you say that because it's been a while since you wrote it. And
it's probably been, I think it's been a full year since I did the last little tweaks on it. I finished it in probably January of last year, but then I rewrote it, and then I wrote it again. And then I think I went through it yet another time. So it was probably really wasn't fully done till about June or July of last year. It's been a year.
There is one thing, and I can't even mention it on the air. I'm going to have to mention it off the air. There's one thing that I think it didn't bother me, but I have this feeling that it's going to bother other people about the book. I'm sorry?
Something in this book.
Yeah, it's just something that I think that, but, you know, I loved it. I don't have a problem with it. I just like the way it's written all the way
Everybody's
through.
Everybody's listening going, what is he talking about? What
well, I don't even know. They may read it and not even think that way. I'm not sure. But there's one thing that, the only reason I mention it is because I've heard people say before I shouldn't even have brought it up. But it's just in the back of my head right now, and for some reason I just feel like saying anything I want to say right now. I don't know why, but nothing to me is wrong with this book, and I can't wait to sell it in the store because it's one of those books you can sell because it's just so good. I mean, it just is. Yeah, and I just love the fact that at first I thought I wasn't going to like it, and then all of a sudden, wow, I'm so deep into this book, and what's going to happen next?
Well, that's made my, it's made my day to hear you say that because, like I said, you're still in many ways one of the early readers, and there's a few people who've read it and reviewed it ahead of time and so forth.
I hope you remember that when the next one comes out and I can get an early copy of that too because I'm dying to read it already.
Yeah, well, it's like we think this one's pretty cool. It's probably, I think it's the best hook or the best concept I've had since No Time for Goodbye, which I thought was a great sort of concept.
Well, and also the other one where the at the amusement park where the child disappears and then the child's found. I mean, that's then something else happens after that, which is unexpected.
I know. I kind of like to sort of play with people's expectations. The previous book was Never Look Away, which came out in paperback just this past week, and that was the one we were thrilled to hear. This Stephen King, out of the blue, we heard from him. He read Never Look Away. I don't even know who put it in his hands or whatever, but he said he thought it was the best thriller he'd read in the last 5 years.
What a thrill that must have been.
That was really nice to hear. And in fact, he has read The Accident, and we gave him an advanced copy, and he's read it, and he thought it was better than Never Look Away. He loved it. And But Never Look Away starts as one of those stories you think, oh yeah, I've read this before. Family goes to the amusement park. They lose track of their kid. Kid goes missing. You think, yeah, I know what this story is, but that's not what it is. It's something else. Before that prologue is done, they found that kid, and something else happened.
Well, then you think to yourself, well, wait a minute. They found the kid already? I just started the book. What's going to happen
now?
Yeah.
There's 300 pages left. What are we going to talk about?
It's just, I really like the way you write, and I know I'm gushing, but I don't care because I think you're a really talented writer, and I've read writers that aren't talented, and I've also recently read writers where there's mistakes in their books. I didn't find one mistake in this book. Nothing. No.
You know, there is one. I just found it yesterday.
Oh, really?
I didn't even find it. It was found. There's a mistake in the accident, and it's not a huge one, but it's
I had no idea you were going to say that, so I'm not setting myself.
None of us knew. I don't know how many people have read through that book and edited it and gone through it with a fine-tooth comb, and and 2 days ago I hear from the person who's translating it, it's German, and they said there is a phone message, the voicemail message that the woman has like on her phone, like if you call her, it says, "Hi, you've reached so-and-so, I'm not here right now." There's two times when it's referenced, and they're different.
Oh, really?
And, you know, anybody who's really sharp will read that and think it's a clue, but it's not. I just screwed up. These things happen. You know, you're creating an entire, you're inventing an entire universe, really.
Well, let me give you a secret. There's a best-selling book out there right now where the author mentions Joseph Smith, the Mormon guy, and then mysteriously his name changes to John Smith later in the book.
Oh, yeah.
So don't feel so bad. It happens to all of you.
I have done that, but we've caught it. I have done that sort of thing, but we've caught it.
That's the thing. It's so easy to do.
It's very easy. And in fact, we had there was another mistake that I caught in the proofs at the last minute of in the accident where there's a reference to his daughter, and I have a totally different name there for her.
I think what you need to do is whoever found that error, that's the person that needs to read the book beforehand.
Well, you know, I think it's because I've had this happen before where the translators find something that no one else did. It's because they're looking at it in a way like no one else has. They're translating, excuse me, they're looking at every single sentence so carefully because they're transcribing it into a different language that they see things that other people don't see. And I've had that happen before where it was only someone who was translating it into a foreign language caught the mistake that everybody editing it in English had missed.
Now, do you have a title for the next book?
At the moment, we think it's going to be called 360.
Oh, that's right. I did see something. I saw that something on Fantastic Fiction about that. I did. I remember.
360 is what we're intending to call it. 360, as in degrees.
It doesn't sound like you're really convinced you're going to keep that title, though.
Well, the only reason that we might not is whether it presents sort of a cataloging problem or a search problem. Like if you enter in just a number to try to find something, is it going to come out, or do we need to spell it out as in 360? I mean, that's the only thing that might change it. Or is everybody going to look it up and they're going to get referred to a PlayStation or a Playbox or whatever the hell it is?
Oh, that's true.
But we think it's going to be all right. But we have lots of time. But I mean, we think because it would be it's probably 13 months from now before it's going to come out. But but at the moment we're calling it 360.
Are you happy where you are right now? I mean, are you happy with the sales? Are you happy with everything in general? Or are you still striving for better?
Well, I think we're always striving for more, but
More what?
I'd love to hit that New York Times list strong in the U.S.
I'm amazed you haven't yet.
I had a book come out of paperback a month ago in England, and they measure book sales from Sunday to Saturday, Saturday, in any given week. My book came out on a Thursday. In 3 days, we sold enough. In 3 days, we sold enough books to hit number two on the bestseller list.
Wow.
And in England, it's crazy over there for me. I do really, really well there. And I'd like to start getting, becoming even better known in the U.S. than I am at this point. But I have to say, I feel very, very fortunate. I feel very lucky. I mean, 7 years ago, I was starting to write fiction, and I thought, well, this is great. I mean, I've always wanted to get a book published. It couldn't get any better than this, but it keeps getting better.
Well, who do you use to bounce your ideas off of? I mean, you come up with all these ideas. Do you have somebody that you go to? And I mean, whether it's your editor or whoever, do you say to them?
Most often it's my agent, because she's not only does she sort of manage the sales of my books, she's a former editor and she's got a great sense of story and plot development, what works and what doesn't.
So she'll actually tell you that doesn't work?
Oh, she's in a heartbeat. You know, she'll say, well, that's nice, but here's why it's not going to work, or here's your problem, and so forth.
Do you ever get offended when she says that?
No, I'm past that. And I mean, when I was preparing, when I finished writing those four comic thrillers, I thought I need a really great, great hook, like a great way into a book. And I would send my agent an idea, and I'd say, this is it. And she would email back, and she'd say, no, it isn't. That's not any good. And so one morning I send her an email and I say, girl wakes up 14 years old, family's all gone, 25 years go by, she doesn't know what happened to him. I sent that to her. 10 minutes later, the phone rings. She says, that's it. That's a fantastic hook into a story. And because she's the agent, she wants to know everything. She says, what happened to the family? And I said, I don't know. I have absolutely no idea.
Uh-huh.
We'll figure that out.
And see, that's another point with a book, too. There are a lot of books nowadays where there's a great premise, but the great premise does not necessarily mean it's going to be a great book.
No, and my feeling is I have to get a great premise, and I have to know then before I start that it's going to work. Like, it has to work. And I had that premise for No Time for Goodbye, and I think all the books I've done, I look for a fabulous premise and then start thinking, can I make this work? And I think in the accent, I'm hoping we pulled it off.
Now, do you read other people's, do you read other authors? Do you have time to?
I probably read a book a week. I'm always reading. I don't necessarily read a lot of people who do the exact same kind of thing that I'm doing.
Right.
I read all kinds of books. And, I would say probably it's weighted certainly towards crime fiction. But, and I have favorite authors that I love, people like Elmore Leonard and George Pelicanos and James Lee Burke and a whole raft of others. But, I mean, I love Philip Roth. I'm kind of sampling of different things.
Yeah, that's it.
But go ahead.
You know, some authors will say that they have to be careful that if they read too much in the genre, that it might rub off a little bit. You know, there might be some kind of a... it's in your head, and now when you go to write your book, you're going to be thinking about it and thinking of a clever way to use it or you know, not use the whole thing. There's some little detail.
Sometimes you need to be reading everybody, because if you don't read them, then you'll write something and realize someone else has, and you won't know that somebody else has done it. So it kind of cuts both ways. But I don't know. I mostly try to read, I mean, not exclusively, but I like to read people who I know are a hell of a lot better than I am. And I think I can still be learning a lot. And, you know, when I read James Lee Burke, I think, I'm glad you don't have to be this good to get published. because I think he's such a fantastic writer.
Mm-hmm.
And so you think, well, I'm just going to read all these other people and see if I can keep learning some things from them.
I mean, you think about it, your published Bantam is who publishes Dean Koontz. I mean, you're with a huge publishing company, I mean, and they've put a lot of trust in you. It's an amazing thing. I mean, and you're good at what you do, so it's got to give you kind of...
It's particularly pleasing to me to be with Bantam because when I was a kid growing up, my favorite writer in the whole world was Ross MacDonald, who wrote the Lou Archer series of novels. And they were all in Bantam paperbacks. And I read all the Rex Stout's books about Nero Wolfe, and all Bantam paperbacks. And, I mean, I grew up reading those, reading Bantam. And I think even Ray Bradbury were Bantam paperbacks when I was growing up.
Ray Bradbury's still going strong.
Yeah, I know. And so it's very cool to be published by them.
And it's got to give you some kind of a thrill to know that, you know, we're unfortunately in a society where with age comes, you know, doubt whether you're going to have a job tomorrow. I mean, but age to you doesn't mean anything. You still know how to write. You've still got that ability, no matter how old you are, to be able to write.
Yeah, and I think it also means that you're inclined not to retire, you know. And
not if you enjoy it.
You know, as long as you're having fun, I mean... Somebody sort of raised the idea, well, maybe when you're 60, you won't really have to keep working. You could just pack it in and just won't have to do anymore.
Right.
And I think, but what will I do with myself? Like, if I think you just need...
Travel with your wife?
Well, but you need... But we've been doing a lot of traveling now. God, in the last 6 weeks, we've been to Italy and New York City and England. We've been all over the place on book-related stuff. And, but I think that if you have this kind of impulse to create, whether it's music or whatever, you know, or you just want to do it, and I can't, it's hard for me. I think as long as I'm enjoying it, as long as I'm able to do it, I will keep writing.
And the thing that makes you a good author is the fact that you flesh out these characters so well. That is, I mean, you don't realize, you do realize probably how vital it is that every character has to be. It has to feel like they're real. It can't be anybody. You can't sugarcoat them and make them seem like somebody you've met before. They have to jump off the page and like, I care about this person. I care about Glenn. I care about his daughter. I care about these other people. And I'm feeling all these emotions toward Glenn. Like I said, I mean, one minute I love him, next minute I'm mad at him for doing what he's doing, and then I wonder, you know, he's just going to totally derail. By the middle of this book, he's just going to be in an insane asylum in a straitjacket.
Well, you know, I just didn't want to make him perfect, and I mean, I think that's very true of you know, we'll talk about it next year. The main character in 360. I mean, there are times when you just want to, you're just really mad at him, but. I mean, ultimately, by the end, I think you think, you know, I took this trip with Glenn Garber, and it was quite a ride, and I liked that guy. You know, I didn't like him on every page, but when all is said and done, I understand his motivations. I understand why he did what he did. I admire the fact that he did all this, you know, that he cares so much about his daughter, and that he knows, I think, ultimately what's right and what's wrong. And I think that you'll come away from it, and you'll like this guy.
And another thing, there's another point. There's a character in this book that I actually hated when they first came onto the page. By the end of the book, I actually felt like I was feeling some sympathy for this. I can't tell you the character, though. I might give something away.
I think we could say who it was without giving too much away. What character was that?
Fiona.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I felt myself... But I, without giving too much away, and I don't want to give anything away, but I was starting to feel sorry for her at the end, and starting to feel like she was turning into a real person. So I like that transformation of her.
Yeah,
I want to think that that changed her life.
I think so. There's a lot. I think you want to have these kind of shadings in your characters that they're not just sort of stereotypes. Oh, this is the mean person. This is the one we like. So, but that everybody has these different shadings to their character, and that. You know, there's things about them we like and things that we don't.
And that's another beautiful thing about your writing, that it can engender all this talk and all this discussion. I mean, this is a great discussion book because there's so many things you can talk about. But you have to wait. Of course, you have to wait till everybody's read it. You can't.
Yeah, except we can't talk about it now.
But I'm wondering one other thing, though. What in your eyes, makes 360 even a better book without getting into too much detail about the book?
It's, like I said, I'm not even going to tell you anything about it, but it has...
You can't even tell us anything about it?
I'm not telling you anything about it, but I think it has sort of the best concept that I've had in a very long time. You know, just as a kind of...
Yeah, we don't want anybody to steal the concept if they hear it.
We don't. It's just such a great concept.
Well, I hope I get to read it soon.
And in some ways, I'm scared to breathe a word of it because I can't believe no one else has done it yet. But I think it's a real kind of high concept, neat idea.
And now I'm going to lay awake tonight wondering what it's about. You know that. And no, I'm not a spy for any other author. I wouldn't dare give away anything with an author.
No.
But you've really got me curious now.
Yeah, I think it's now, like I say, the only thing that scares me now is that I got to come up with a book after that. But it's got a great, it's a really cool concept.
Why does that scare you so much to come up with a book after that? I mean, why do you get so, do you really think that you're not going to come up with something?
Well, I think I will, but I think that there's an expectation that, at least to me and for myself, that, you know, if you don't get better with each book, then you're doing something wrong. Like you should learn from every book. You should be getting better at your craft. So every book should be better than the one that came before it.
It makes me wonder if somebody came up to you and said, that one of your books, that they hated one of your books, how would you react to that? I mean, how would you react?
I've had people. I mean, that was funny. I went on a tour one time and somebody came up and said, oh, I loved your book about this last book of yours. So I'm reading the new one now and I think it's kind of lame, she said. So but you know what? I mean, that's the way it is.
There's going to be people with every book that think that.
You can go on Amazon and see a 5-star review for my book that says, I just love this book. It was so fast-paced and I love the characters. Next review is a 1-star review. It says, I hated this book. The characters were all two-dimensional and it's just dragged and dragged. And I think, it's the same book. You know, but we all have different tastes. Everything, you know, it connects with us in a different way.
I think as an author, you really can't have it. You can't care too much. I mean, unless it helps
your
writing.
You can't worry about it. You have to write the best book that you can write. That's about, you know, that you want to do. That's all you can do. And people are going to love it or hate it. And it's going to be both. They're going to be some who loved it and some who hated it.
I mean, the biggest shock would be if you've been reading... I've been reading Dean Koontz for years and years and years, and every once in a while he'll write a bad book, and I'll be very disappointed. But, I mean, that might happen with any author.
It does. Listen, we got our off days, and sometimes you knock one out of the park, and it's like, yeah, you know, and... I mean, I have books that I like more than that I've done that I like more than others, and so you just do the best you can. And it's funny. I mean, you can just knock yourself out trying to do a new book that you think is just the best one you've ever done, and then someone reviews it and says, "Well, clearly he's slacking off, and he's just mailing it in now." And I think, "Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like I just killed myself in that." But that's just, I mean, you know, when you put them out there, you have to expect that. And then, you know, if you're not prepared to take that kind of criticism and deal with it, then you should go into another line of work.
Right. Well, this has been absolutely a pleasure.
It's been a real pleasure. Dave, it's been a lot of fun.
I really enjoyed talking to you, and I really enjoyed the accident. I can't wait for everybody to read it and get their reaction.
Listen, I thank you for spreading the good word on it. Like I said earlier, word of mouth is everything, and this is tremendously helpful to me that you would pass the good word on this book. I really appreciate it.
And the book, again, is called The Accident. It's available from Bantam starting August 9th in all your bookstores, so look for it then. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.